Hello, and welcome once again to a MANCAD, British Academy of Audiology podcast. You probably know by now that MANCAD stands for Manchester Centre for Audiology and Deafness, and that we're located at the University of Manchester in the UK. I'm Gabrielle, or Gabby Saunders. I'm a Senior Research Fellow at MANCAD, and I moderate these podcasts. And we're addressing topics that are pertinent to the practice of audiology. Some are focused specifically on COVID-related issues, and others are more broad. And what they all have in common, though, is that relevant to audiologists and researchers and people generally interested in hearing and hearing loss. We have a new podcast each month. They last 20 to 30 minutes. And what I do is I put the audio recording along with a transcript on the MANCAD University of Manchester webpages. And if you want the URL for that, if you click on the transcript that's attached to this podcast, you can find it. So on to today, we have our first double bill. I'm going to be chatting to Siobhan Brennan and Keaton Palmer. Siobhan is a clinician and lecturer in audiology at the University of MANCAD, and she specializes in care for adults with hearing disabilities. Keaton is an optometrist who's studying for a PhD here at the University of Manchester. I'm going to get them to tell you a little bit more about themselves in a minute, but before I do, I just want to remind you that what we're going to be talking about, and I'm going to be asking questions of them, is about autism, learning disabilities, and access to healthcare services. So just before I begin with the questions, I'm going to first ask you, Siobhan, and then you, Keaton, to say a little bit more about your background and how it relates to today's topic. So Siobhan.
Hello there. So my name is Siobhan Brennan, and as Gabby said, I'm split between the university and clinical work. And one of my specialisms for a long time now has been the audiological care for individuals with learning disabilities, and I lead the cognition and hearing service at Sheffield Teaching Hospitals.
Thank you. And Keaton?
Hi everyone, my name is Ketan Palmer, and by profession I'm a fully qualified optometrist, as Gabby said, and I have been since 2018. But currently I'm studying for a PhD at the University of Manchester, which is investigating links between autism and vision. Now, part of this project is also looking at how eye examinations and eye care services could be made more accessible for autistic patients.
Great. So that's going to be interesting because we're not, you know, it's going to give a different view on things because we normally don't talk to audiologists. So that's going to be really interesting. All right. So now I'm going to move on to my questions then. So you said we're going to be talking about autism, learning disabilities, and access to healthcare services. And there's a lot to unpack here and a lot comes to mind. So let's first begin with talking about autism versus learning disabilities. You've specifically distinguished between them in the title. And what do you, are you saying that because you want to imply that the considerations for the two are different, or that they're very, they are the same, or what?
So I would say that frequently in clinic, whenever I inquire about the cause of a person's learning disabilities, I'm told by carers, oh, this person has autism. So, and it's presented as if that is a cause. And certainly while there is a high coincidence of autism in individuals with learning disabilities, one is not a cause of the other. They are two separate issues. And I think it's very, very, very important for us to bear that in mind. So whenever I'm talking about learning disabilities, I'm talking specifically of an intellectual impairment in terms of the ability to understand new concepts, which has been present since childhood. And the intellectual impairment is sufficient to affect that person's life. And so it does not, for instance, include a specific educational difficulties like dyslexia.
Okay, that's interesting. So Keaton, if you would tell us a bit about autism, but also whether or not, you know, every person with autism has learning disabilities or it's just a subset.
Definitely. So I'll start off with your first question. So what is autism? So it's a lifelong neurodevelopmental condition with its main impacts on sociability, communication and behaviour. So just a few examples in each of these areas. Socially, an autistic person might have difficulty initiating a conversation or continuing it, understanding simple questions and instructions, and expressing their emotions, as well as understanding others' emotions. Communication-wise, an autistic person may lack eye contact, facial expressions during a conversation. They may deliver speech unusually, like might be very structured or song-like, and they may have difficulty interpreting non-verbal cues such as eye signals. And behaviourally, an autistic person may repeat certain actions or movements, may have coordination issues, altered ability to copy actions, so imitation, and altered sensory reactivity. So this altered sensory reactivity refers to either an increased hyper or decreased hyposensitivity to sensory inputs or sensory seeking behaviours. Now going to the second part, autism in itself is not a learning disability, which is a very big misconception. Unless it's specified on the person's diagnostic documents, an autistic person does not have an intellectual impairment. And behind that, a third of autistic individuals have a coexisting learning disability. So again, emphasizing that point, autism is not a learning disability. At this point, I'll just throw in two more figures. So 1% of adults and just over 1.5% of children are autistic in the UK. And 4 to 5 times as many men are diagnosed as autistic than females. And it's long considered that many females are underdiagnosed.
Interesting. Okay, so that was really helpful. So now then, let's move on to healthcare access. What are the barriers to healthcare access for people with autism and learning disabilities then?
So I'll kick off there. So just some general thoughts about barriers to accessing healthcare for autistic people. So autistic individuals are generally more likely to develop more health issues and have poorer physical and mental health. Various reports and studies have highlighted that there are significant barriers to accessing healthcare services for autistic people, but these are different to the barriers which you'd expect for non-autistic people. There are few services in the UK which are adapted to be autism friendly. So that's thinking about the clinic setting, the flow of the appointments, the awareness about autism of the service providers, which is at present poor. Autistic individuals can have some of their health concerns, unfortunately, just dismissed as being a result of autism. And the altered sensory reactivity, which I mentioned earlier, that can result in various sensory experiences. And these can have significant impacts on the ability of an autistic person to physically access a healthcare setting. So that's thinking about the layout of the clinic, how it's decorated, the sounds there, the noise levels there, the smells there, the temperature there, etc.
Further to that, actually, I would add in terms of some of the barriers for individuals with learning disabilities. There's lots of evidence, for instance, that there's quite low rates of self-report of difficulties within that population and low identification of hearing issues, particularly by carers. So overshadowing frequently occurs. So this is where a carer or healthcare worker or a referrer, indeed, will attribute an individual's lack of communication or lack of responses to sound to their learning disabilities, as opposed to considering there may be a hearing loss.
Gosh, okay. So it's differentiating between the hearing loss and the other conditions. Wow, that does make it pretty hard. There are clearly major barriers for these populations. Since I think most people who listen to these podcasts are likely to be people with an interest in hearing, I'd like to know more about how hearing loss fits into this, both from the perspective of how many people there are that have learning disabilities and hearing loss and autism and hearing loss. Is it more than the general population? But then also from a diagnostic and service provision perspective. So first of all, in terms of prevalence of hearing loss among people with learning disabilities and autism, is that different from the general population?
It certainly is. So certainly in individuals with intellectual disabilities, the prevalence, like anything, varies across studies. But the estimate that's most commonly used is between 30 and 40% of individuals with learning disabilities are thought to have a hearing loss. But that could well be an underestimation because a lot of these prevalence figures come from the Special Olympics. And the athletes in the Special Olympics generally tend to be very healthy. They also tend to have milder learning disabilities on the whole than the wider population. And so the prevalence of hearing loss may be greater again. In individuals with autism, in terms of the prevalence of hearing loss, that's thought to be closer to that of the wider population. But again, it varies across studies and with age as well. And I think one of the risks sometimes is that for individuals, for autistic individuals, a factor that frequently drives the referral is perhaps a hypersensitivity to sound that is causing concern. But I think something that needs to be borne in mind is that that does not rule out the possibility of a coincident hearing loss as well. And so a test of thresholds should be, as a minimum, included in the assessment. Also, I think in terms of the diagnostic and service provision there needs to be an awful lot more flexibility whenever it comes to possible assessment for individuals with learning disabilities. So, for example, in a specialist service, generally speaking, about 75% of individuals with learning disabilities in a specialist service can have hearing assessed using behavioural methods of some type. So that means about a quarter may need some form of electrophysiology, but only a very, very small number may need hearing assessment under general anaesthetic. So locally, for instance, we found it's less than 3% of those that we see would we need to consider under general anaesthetic. And I think that that returns to some of the barriers. I think that there is a general misconception that hearing assessment is not feasible within this population when that's simply not true.
Interesting. Yeah, so you sort of touched on this just now about the complications of differentiating hearing loss from sensory issues. And maybe, you know, it pops over into vision loss as well. I don't know. Do you want to expand a bit on that? Because it does sound like a complex interaction there.
Absolutely. Well, certainly there are a lot of referrals in because there's concern about somebody's relationship with sound. And we work closely with our hearing therapist, for instance, to talk about sensory sensitivities and so on. But in terms of the impact that that can potentially have on the hearing assessment, that's certainly a factor. And there can be some anxiety for autistic people when they come to have a hearing assessment that they may be exposed to loud sounds within the clinic. And I think that there has to be some reassurances put in place.
Yeah, interesting. So Keaton, from the, because you're an optometrist, right? So I guess, do you want to tell us a bit about the issues that you encounter with the vision side of things and how they likely overlap with hearing testing and evaluation?
So adding to what Siobhan said before I come to that, as well as the hypersensitivities, we've also got to keep in mind autistic individuals who may be hyposensitive. So we may find that some of our autistic patients don't respond to tests in a way that we expect. They may not exhibit symptoms to certain findings in a way that we'd expect. They may not react to pain in the same way. So although if we're looking at one side of sensitivity, so being too sensitive to things, we've got to also consider the other side. Now, going back to your question about vision testing, a lot of the generic considerations can be applied across all schools of healthcare. Making sure the patient is expecting what you're going to do, thinking about how close you are to the patient, making sure that the patient is keeping up with what you're saying, just being alert to the fact that the patient isn't becoming stressed or overwhelmed by what you're doing or what you're saying. All these basic principles, which are largely part of just basic patient care, can be applied across all schools by all professionals. But for individuals with autism, and I guess with learning disabilities too, if these basic points aren't covered, they can be quite detrimental to the ability of that person and the willingness of that person to want to continue to access those services.
So have you got kind of general advice for how that this can all be managed?
Definitely. So there's lots of advice available. But like I said, the basic points are generic, can be applied across all schools. whatever I mention now are not all the considerations. So if there is any listeners who want to look further, they will find more specific things and maybe to their clinics and their clinical settings. The main aim of a lot of the considerations are to reduce the negative emotional responses associated with the consultation and visiting the clinic. So that might be worry, stress, anxiety, fear, but also to reduce the sensory experiences which could impact the flow of the consultation too. So I will cover some points briefly. So the first area is communication. So communication is important for all of our patients. So they know why they're seeing us, what we're doing and what the outcomes are. But for an autistic person, there are some more specific considerations. Now, we should provide an electronic means of communication for our patients. Now, most of our services are accessible by telephone and telephone only usually. But for autistic people, it can be anxiety inducing having to communicate with a stranger either in person, but especially over the phone. And many autistic people avoid using the phone, and this can actually lead to a limitation to accessing healthcare services. So if an autistic person is able to contact the clinic by email, text, or by an online portal, that will actually facilitate use of those services. Similarly, professionals should use as many visual aids as possible during the consultation. Again, just to make sure that the patient is fully understanding what you're telling them and prepared for what's to come. So again, there's not that sudden spike in anxiety. We should use specific questioning because some autistic people can take our questioning quite literally. So if we're not clear with what the test involves and what we're expecting from the patient, that can again lead the patient feeling confused and again, making them feel anxious and worried that they might respond in a way or may not be understanding the test properly, which could jeopardize the outcomes of the examination. Again, we should make our communication extremely clear when we're giving information to the patient, but make sure that you're not giving long reams because you need to ensure that your patient's keeping up with what you're saying and processing what you're saying. And it's also finally important to try and give some written advice to our autistic patients so that they can go away and in their own time and in their own space process the outcomes. And if it's not possible to write down the outcomes during the actual examination, why not offer just to send a report, either in the post or electronically? Now, looking at the appointment as a whole, we should maybe offer, if possible, appointments at quieter times of the day to autistic patients. And that might be the case also for patients with a learning disability. Considering the sensory issues, and if you're inviting a patient to the clinic at a busy time of day where there's going to be lots of people, lots of movement, lots of sounds, that can result in lots of sensory issues, anxiety, that can actually have an impact on the consultation even before it's begun. In a similar way, we should try and offer longer appointment slots. Just keeping in mind that you might need to be aware of the patient getting overwhelmed or stressed during the appointment, so they need to have some breaks. They may need more explanation. They may need more time to complete the tests because they're just understanding what needs doing. A very basic point is just to make the patient feel comfortable. That's part of all of our basic training. Just introduce yourself, tell them what you're going to do. Let them settle in to the consultation environment. Have some general conversation, general chit-chat too. And one last thing I'll mention is trying to see the patient and as best as possible on time. Now, for autistic people, they can be quite precise and accurate and can turn up at the clinic way in advance of their appointment so they are ready for you to see them on time. Now, as a healthcare professional, I'm sure Siobhan will agree with this. Most of the time, we don't see our patients at the given time. We'll see them earlier or later. But it's just important that we let our patients know about that, either when they book in at the desk or when they're in the waiting area. And don't just give throwaway comments such as, oh, I'll be as quick as possible, or I'll just be 2 minutes, because it will be the autistic patient who's on the edge of their seat counting those 2 minutes. And if you don't see them within that time, then again, for them, it can set off a load of anxieties and worries. Have I been missed? Have I been forgotten about? Will I not have my concerns looked into today, etc., etc.? So yes, those are some of the possible considerations that can be kept in mind by our professionals.
Yeah, these all make a lot of sense, and they're almost kind of common sense if you think about it. So if you're going to sort of bear all these things in mind, I guess you have to know up front that somebody is autistic. So does that tend to follow their clinic notes wherever they go?
Well, it's interesting that you mention that, because it's paramount for our services and clinics to ask our patients in advance if they have any accessibility needs. And that's a point, that's a perfect point where our patients can come forward and tell us that I'm autistic, or this patient has a learning disability, I'm sensitive to lights, I'm sensitive to sounds, I'm undersensitive to X, Y, and Z. So it allows the practitioners and the clinics to prepare in advance and think about those adaptations so they're not put on the spot. But it has a two-way advantage, actually, because it also shows the patient that as a clinic and a service, we're willing to adapt to make them feel more comfortable.
And I think I would add to that slightly to raise the question of the soundproof room. These are spaces that not the whole population is familiar with, and how somebody's going to react to a soundproof space, I think, is really interesting, because it varies so much from person to person, and it's worth making that person aware of the fact that they are going to be in this sound-treated space, and for them to be thinking through how they might experience that.
If I can add back to what Siobhan's just said, there's some things that we just have to do. There's some tests that are conducted in a particular way, and you can't flex from that, apart from just giving lots of information in advance, making the patient feel comfortable, etc. But if we could send, I know for autistic patients, if we were to send them information in advance, and I'm sure this applies to patients with learning disabilities too, like if we were to send a document with pictures of the room, of the tests, some explanation, even maybe some videos, so they can go through that and watch that in advance, they'll be a bit more prepared for what's to happen. And it kind of reduces the capacity required to deal with. And for the clinic staff, if they were to have some form of basic autism training, like access to their local trusts, that would also give them some awareness of the factors that would affect an autistic person, but also in relation to that clinic as well, and clinic service, so they can think about some adaptations and changes too. And some good news is that soon it is going to become mandatory for clinic staff to have autism training, so that's in the pipeline.
Oh, that is good to hear. I was actually going to ask what is the NHS perspective on this? Are there guidelines, and do they have priorities for these populations?
Absolutely, absolutely. This is very much a priority for the NHS. Both autism and learning disabilities are highlighted in the NHS long-term plan published in 2019. And there's also a number of recent publications which support a focus for these populations. So Public Health England, for instance, published a key document entitled Improving the Health and Wellbeing of People with Learning Disabilities in 2015. There's also the National Learning Disabilities Mortality Review Programme, which publishes a report every year and aims to make improvements for people with learning disabilities. And yes, in terms of that mandatory training for Health and Social Care, Department of Health is going to be introducing that. And it's training for health and social care in working with both autistic people and individuals with learning disabilities.
That's really good to hear. I'm going to ask just one more question, because we've covered quite a lot and time is moving on. But I think generally when people think about learning disabilities and autism, a pediatric population jumps to mind. And obviously these things don't go away when you reach adulthood. So What are the special considerations or issues that you think adults with learning disabilities and autism encounter that we might be forgetting about because we sort of have this mindset that this is a pediatric issue?
I think one of the factors that I would say is that there does seem to be a greater deal of funding and resource and support around children's services, and the fact that the care scenario that somebody may be in is likely to change over time. So as opposed to living with family, somebody may live in residential care, being cared for by professionals. And that care can be very different. Also, certainly one of the things that we've observed and has been reported is the fact that the cause of intellectual disabilities is not known for a significant percentage of those seen by a service, and therefore how you should adapt your care will be limited a little in as much as the cause of somebody's intellectual disabilities is not known for some, whereas with children a much greater percentage it may be known because there's more investigation that goes on at that point. So the numbers whenever we get to adulthood who are not known is going to hopefully decrease over time.
Okay, Keaton, do you want to add anything to that?
I completely agree with everything that Siobhan's covered, that there's a lot more attention to autism and learning disabilities in children populations. Around about 1% of adults in the UK, just over 1.5% of children in the UK are autistic. So there's a difference in that number. Why is that? So many autistic individuals are diagnosed when they are in adulthood. But it's the adults without learning disabilities who are regularly overlooked. And this has been found through surveys as well, like the National Audit Office. And it may be just because that tag of learning disability isn't there, or just that autistic individuals without learning disabilities do lead their own lives, but people don't recognize those underlying factors which impact them on a day-to-day basis.
Absolutely. There was one study that suggested that only 20% of adults with learning disabilities are known to learning disability services, and that's because the majority of individuals with learning disabilities have mild learning disabilities and therefore have who could benefit from support but are perhaps unaware of the fact that support applies to them and could be beneficial for them.
Yeah, that's what I was thinking, because they have to be in, like, as a child, you've got a parent seeking help for you. You could easily, if you're not able or willing to self-advocate, I guess you could disappear off the radar kind of thing.
Something to add here is that, yes, healthcare providers and professionals may not be aware or may not have a good level of knowledge about these special populations. But they're not always to blame either, because you don't regularly receive autism-specific training as part of your degree qualification or postgraduate training. And that, again, has been found in a survey by the National Audit Office with GPs. And so that awareness needs bumping up there, because I can give my own personal experience. The first time I saw an autistic patient, I felt really out of my depth, because you know it's not a learning disability, so you can't be patronizing to the patient, you can't be childlike to the patient. But what are those specific changes you should make? And I had to kind of learn that on the job. It was the patient telling me, can you repeat that? Can you tell me in smaller chunks? Can you just give me a break so I can process what you're saying? Can I just have a minute, because I'm just feeling a bit overwhelmed? And if there was just a bit more focus on autism without learning disabilities, even at training level, undergraduate level, that would actually send professionals into their practice a lot more equipped.
Yeah, gosh, you've given us a lot to think about. Siobhan, what were you going to say?
Yes, I couldn't agree more in terms of the need for training. Also, at the point where people are doing their initial training, as well as it now being introduced to healthcare staff who are already in services, but also at that point where they are learning generally, I think it's a really, really important populations. They're both really, really important populations to be learning about. And as I say, because of that need for I would argue there's a very strong need, in particular in terms of adult services, for individuals with learning disabilities, and how their needs differ very much to those of children, and how adults should be seen as adults. I think that there's a risk as well that there's too much attribution of adults with learning disabilities occasionally being seen in a paediatric manner, there have been reports of adults with learning disabilities being seen by paediatric services, which is very unfortunate, and I think that it really needs some focus.
Wow, yeah. So it sounds like education, to a certain extent, common sense and awareness, I guess, maybe be the key kind of things to think about. Thank you both very much. That was really interesting. I feel like we could talk about this for a long time and we could all keep learning about the topic. So back to the audience. So thank you for listening. We will be putting together a transcript, and in it, we will list references to the work and resources that Keaton and Siobhan referred to. If you do have any follow-up questions, or you want to give feedback or make requests for topics for future podcasts, you can send me an email. I hope you enjoyed the discussion and that you'll come back to hear our next podcast, and we'll get the word out when the next one is available. And in the meantime, farewell and stay well.